Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Living free.
Welcome to the Living Free Show on 3CR Community Radio 855 kHz on your AM radio dial and 3CR on digital radio. I'm Anne, and we'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, traditional owners of the land from which 3CR transmits people-powered radio. We'd like to pay our respects to elders past and present and emerging, and to acknowledge that this land was stolen and that sovereignty over this land was never ceded. Each week on the Living Free Show, we showcase one of the many programs that assist in recovery from drug, alcohol, gambling, food, and other addictions. Our guests share their recovery stories and highlight that shared experience saves lives. We're off to a little bit of a slow start today, but we've got, as well as our lovely guest, Phoebe Lou. Welcome, Phoebe Lou.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in. Got the also lovely Zakia. How are you?
Hi, Anne, I'm good. How are you?
Good, good, good. All right, so today the focus is on Al-Anon family groups, and Phoebe Lou is a member of Al-Anon, and she has come in to share her recovery story. Before we start, I'd like to remind you that the Living Free Show may involve discussion of topics such as suicide, mental illness, self-harm, and family violence. Please practice self-care and care of others when listening. So, Phoebe Lou, I've known you for 2 years, but I don't know everything about you, so today you're going to tell us everything.
Wonderful.
No pressure at all. Where did it all start for you? Where were you born?
Excellent. I was born in Sydney, and I usually say I was raised in semi-rural Sydney. I was thinking the other day, that's not really true. I was actually, my first recollection was in Point Clair, which is Central Coast.
Oh, okay.
Central Coast. There was only one small memory there, and it was me dressing up as a cowgirl and getting my skin caught in the zipper, a metal zipper. And going out to my mum and dad at the dinner table and saying, I've got my skin caught in a zipper, help me, and getting into trouble.
Getting into trouble for that. Oh.
So making sure I went back to bed very swiftly. So I grew up most of my childhood in, semi-rural Sydney, and it was wonderful. Long bushwalks. We used to say to Mum, early in the morning, I'll see you before sundown, and just go for bushwalks, long bushwalks. Mm-hmm. And I don't really remember sticking to a trail. We just knew that if there was a snake, you walk around, don't disturb it. And if the bush had flowers on it and there was only one, you don't pick it. I don't know how we knew. And so in my mind's eye as a child, it was idyllic. We lived in a few houses. One of them was a beautiful, in my mind's eye, a green fibro shack. We had tank water, and when there was no rain, we used to have Bill, the waterman, who was, I don't know how we knew this, but he used to drive a few sheets to the wind down our very long driveway, drunk as a skunk, and deliver water to us. Right. And, it was all fine. And, you know, Dad worked really hard. He was an electrician. Mum worked really hard, you know, raised us kids and went back to work cleaning houses. Would take my sister along to do that. And one day Dad was driving home. I remember, you know, I was up in the back shed getting up to a bit of mischief, you know, substantial mischief. And I could hear Mum screaming and she banged on the, you know, corrugated iron shed and she was saying, you know, come down, come down. And so me and my friend that I was getting up to mischief with, we came down to the house and there were police and we were thinking, this is odd. And so we jumped in Mum's car and it was, you know, night had fallen and we went down to a crash site. And, you know, poor Dad had had a major car accident. And so from then, this seemingly perfect lifestyle had shifted to going to hospitals for a year. My dad was unable to walk again. And I don't really remember any alcohol before that stage. And I hardly remember it after. And it's only since coming into the program that it's kind of come back to my mind.
How old were you at that stage?
I was 10.
You were 10.
So it's interesting to I looked at that as being the turning point.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to think, I spent from 10 to, say, 40 thinking that was my problem.
That your father's situation was your problem.
I thought that was the reason for a whole bunch of things. Mm. I thought, and I ended up thinking, well, on paper, I could very easily give you a litany of reasons why that could explain a lot of my behaviour, my choices, my beliefs. And our lives completely changed, you know. Like I didn't feel comfortable going on those bushwalks and leaving Dad. You know, I didn't feel our home life had to change, the house had to change, a lot of things had to change. Yeah. And literally overnight, I became this hyper-vigilant caretaker.
How old you were?
How old?
Yeah.
10.
Can I ask what your position in the family was?
So I was, my brother was 2 years older. Then there was me, and then my sister was 4 years younger. Yeah. So, and we all responded differently, and their stories is theirs. So that was the way I responded.
Did you have a question, Zakia, or should?
No, I just wondered how old you were at the time you were looking after the family.
Well, my mum definitely was just
uncharted.
She was definitely remarkable in this, to be able to watch her husband. She was, I remember celebrating my dad's 40th, so you can imagine how young they were. I remember turning 40 and thinking, how is that possible that my dad was that young? It didn't dawn on me until I was 40. So the way I responded was, I I actually thought I could make him walk.
Yeah.
I thought I could make him not angry. I thought I could make him happy. I thought I could make my mum happy. I thought I could help my brother feel okay. I thought I could protect my sister.
Mm.
And I was just buckled inside, completely buckled.
Can you take us back to then that, just I'm thinking of that's a pivotal time in your school, in your development too, as you're going into adolescence, going into high school and all of that. So how did that internal buckling manifest, and what were some of the problematic behaviours, because you alluded to that before, that started to emerge at that time?
Mm. There was one thing I vividly remember at school, because I, just before Dad's accident, if I can go back.
Of course.
I felt like I was an entrepreneur. I went to this very small country, you know, tiny school. There was 26 kids from kindy to year six, you know, two rooms, tiny, tiny weatherboard school. And I once went around the school and with a jar I probably had stolen full of pebbles, and I had stolen a raffle ticket booklet and a pad and a pencil from the storeroom. I need to make amends for all this stuff, let me tell you, to the Board of Education, because they've taken down the school. So I can't go back to the school itself. And I went around the school and I said, right, kiddies, if you can guess how many pebbles are in this, you, for a price, of course, you get to win the whole jar. And I made a mozza. It was fantastic. There was 26
That's
kids.
Fantastic.
And they get a jar of pebbles.
They get a jar of pebbles. Bloody silly kids. And so by the end of it, I had a bag full of cash, and I'm like, it's going to take me a day to ride my bike to the corner shop, but I'm going to buy some lollies. This is great. And then the headmistress, she caught me, and I got busted. And it was a disaster. I had to stand in front of the class and I had to read out to them, I must be honest to my classmates.
Yeah.
And that to me was publicly humiliating, because I struggled to read, I struggled to write, and to stand up and speak in front of people.
Yeah.
If you had told that little kid who was nine that this woman who's 40-something or other, 47, that she'd be speaking publicly in front of people.
Yeah, like now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I would say not on your life, not on your life. Yeah. But so your question was, how did it manifest? How did it manifest?
How did it all start to kind of unravel?
Well, it unraveled because before Dad's accident, I was the one who went around the school and said, let's make some cash and let's be confident enough to do that.
Wow. Let's pause right there. How would you characterise such a person now? What does that show about your character?
So that young girl was, there was less fear, and she just went out and she went, I've got an idea, and it might not be all that honest, but I reckon it's an idea I might give a go. And
confidence.
There was confidence and there a bit verbose and I'm going to try it.
Boldness even. Mm.
Bold, and there was little effort.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And the young lady after Dad's accident, the other story was she stood in the middle of two friends that she had, and they both wanted her attention, and she had no idea what to do. It was like, I don't know what to do here. I can't balance both of you at the same time. Like,
So that strength of character has become, you became, with your dad's accident, you became a hero, almost like a, you were doing something quite heroic. What you described before, you thought you could save this man. Mm. So this is your mindset now, and now you've got two people that want something of you, and you you think this is a huge thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like an inconceivable thing that I have too much responsibility that no one asked me to take on. It's like I'm literally trying to save the world here. Yeah. I'm 10.
Yeah.
And no one would know. Your mother wouldn't know that's what's going on, because it sounds so much like an alcoholic family that when the crisis like that happens, or a tragedy, everyone is so in such pain that they retreat into only knowing themselves, knowing how they're feeling, and not being able to see.
Others. Not able to see, or not in this situation to try to look or see different perspective in their family, isn't it?
And like I look at situations then, and I look at situations after that, and it wouldn't be because I'm a bad person, they're a bad person, anyone.
Yeah.
It's not for being a bad person. It's a complete powerlessness to this disease. I found myself unable to balance any other perspective other than one where I was the center.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when I look at my dad and him going through this, and my mum going through what she was going through, of course they were powerless to only see their own perspective.
I
have nothing but compassion.
That's great.
So
we're going to go for a break in a minute, but can you just before the break take that, retell that story just in a minute with the alcohol in it.
So in regards to there being alcohol in that situation,
mm-hmm.
When I'm around a family member with alcohol, the situation is unpredictable.
Mm-hmm.
It's unpleasant, and there's nothing I can do about it. There's nothing. And there comes a point where the alcohol is so habitual,
mm-hmm.
It's like I can't see the person I adore,
mm-hmm.
and they're fading, they're completely fading away.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, wait, we'll have a break a little bit later in the show today, actually, because I'm interested now in you. Can you tell us how your life panned out then, say from the ages of about early high school till the end of high school?
Mm. So I would love to say I matured, mm-hmm. and as a teenager, I found my footing.
Nobody finds their footing as a teenager.
Yeah.
So as a teenager, I became full of angst, rebellion, and more emotionally unstable. Because I looked at my ability to rescue, save, fix, manage, or control my family. My dad's not walking. Mm-hmm. My dad's not getting better. And my poor dad and his battle with this disease is it's a progressive disease, because he never said he had he was an alcoholic, and so I don't say that either. But from what I can see, he really struggled. He really struggled, and there was a time when I didn't know anything about it. But there was a time where I needed to say, "Hey, Dad, if you've had this amount of booze tonight, can you not call me?" Mm-hmm. And that was really, really hard. Mm. And so I ended up, he left the family unit and went on the road, and he found the most beautiful place in all of Australia, up north, on the coast, and I would see him once or twice a year. And so I was with my mum, and I swiftly met a fella and left the family unit. And so I was I was 16, 17, and wow. I got married at 22. Wow. So it was almost like I grew up in a marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What could possibly go wrong with
that? Nothing.
Yeah. We'll go to a break. We'll come back and hear about that.
Mm. Wonderful.
If you're a renter with problems such as repairs, getting your bond back, negotiating a rent hike, or facing eviction, it helps to know your rights. For free information and advice on renting, you can visit Tenants Victoria at www.tenants.vic.org.au, Anika Legal at www.anikalegal.com, or contact your nearest community legal centre. The government is planning to demolish and redevelop high-rise public housing towers in Melbourne. If you're living in a public housing tower and need free legal advice about your options, find your nearest community legal centre at www.fclc.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
Breadline, the new show from the Australian Unemployed Workers Union.
So put down that job plan and listen to us.
6 p.m. every Monday night on 3CR Community Radio.
Choose to use your voice print to access your account when you call us.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
This is a Living Free show on 3CR Digital Radio and live streaming on 3cr.org.au/streaming. And we are talking with Phoebe Liu about recovery from the effects of, let's just call it, family trauma. Does that seem, is that right to you, Phoebe Liu? Recovering from the effects of family trauma.
That's one way to put it.
How else could we put it?
I was talking to a friend the other day who's in the program, and we were talking about trauma, and we were talking about the effects of the family disease of alcoholism, and are they the same or are they different?
Good question.
And when I look at the way I've responded, I think I've responded to my story as though I'm justifying my behaviour because I've been through trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it would seem valid to a point.
Mm-hmm.
And withdrawing was a big one for me. I withdrew a lot.
You withdrew from?
People.
Mm-hmm.
A lot.
All right. Let's go back then. Just before the break, you said you'd got married quite young and grew up within that marriage. Can you talk a little bit now about what you were like in that marriage growing up?
So when we first got married, and even through our courtship, I withdrew from my family and friends.
Mm-hmm.
So we were very insular and we would do everything together. And, you know, isn't that wonderful?
Isn't it romantic?
Oh, it's fantastic. So we'd go to gigs together. We would go to everything together, coffee shops and... because we both lived in the early stages, we both lived with our parents, so we'd get in the Datsun and we'd roll cigarettes and, you know, travel into the city. And I don't know what we did. I certainly didn't have a job. So we would go into the city, go to pool halls because I wasn't even 18 at the time. And yeah. Play pool for gazillion hours and then drive back. He didn't drink. I didn't drink. And then do that on repeat. So when I moved out, he covered my rent. I wasn't self-supporting. So that was something, once I was in the program, I had to really see my behaviour. And I also had to see, I made him responsible for my happiness, my emotional happiness, my spiritual happiness as well, because, I mean, I put him in the place of, like, a higher God in a way, or higher power. I'm like, well, if I'm not happy, it's his fault. If I'm not feeling pretty, it's because he hasn't given me a compliment. If I'm, it's pretty much... it all banks on this one fella. And that's a tall order for one human being. Mm. So my behaviour and my belief system was focused around this one person.
Can I ask you, that's the, in a way, the exact opposite of your relationship with your father, in that you were trying to save your father and the rest of your family, and now you're in a position of you want to be saved. The common thing is that you're sort of too focused on someone else. But how do you understand that? How do you understand the connection, if any?
Mm. Well, the beauty of being in the program now is I don't need to throw any logic at any of this stuff, which is brilliant.
That's true.
All I need to do is the program and it's sorted out for me, which is the beauty of it.
Uh-huh.
Thankfully, it's a spiritual program, not a psychological one. I spent many, many, many years in various rooms to help me figure all that stuff out. All I have to do is, you know...
Can you just for the sake of the listener who might be identifying with you, can you just give a bit of a list, Stephen, without any details, a list of all the things you did to figure it out and get better when you thought that figuring it out was the answer? What did you try?
Oh, dear. And I will preface it with none of the things I tried are bad, wrong or inappropriate in of themselves. because I will no doubt do them again, do them for a time. I may even still do them to this day, but in and of themselves, on their own, did not help me get to where I need to be to find what I was actually looking for. But on their own, in a room on its own. So I would Google things. That'll help me. Self-knowledge, that'll help. That'll sort it out. I will buckle up. I will... a bit of willpower.
I'll behave properly.
I will sort this out, this behavioural anomaly, this inability, my inability to stop this behaviour. So I will throw everything I have at my inability to obsess over...
To stop obsessing?
Obsessing. Or control. My inability to, if I'm thinking about someone, something, or wanting to control someone or something, I'll be able to do that. So willpower alone just could not sort this out. So I even sent myself over, we were talking about this before the show, I sent myself over to Florida. Surely that would help.
You think if there's going to be an answer, surely it's going to be in Florida or LA?
Well, I mean, Disneyland would have been nice. But, you know, I did they call it a geographical. I'm like, well, if New South Wales isn't going to help me, then beautiful, freezing cold Melbourne will sort this out. I mean, it could have been nice, warm Queensland. What was I thinking? Mm-hmm. So I moved. I changed jobs, I changed partners, I changed the genders of partners. I mean, none of these things were of top of mind to fix me, but I mean, these things happened. This is my experience. I left alcoholics. They passed away. Surely, with no... active drinking in my life, I would be as sane as a saint. None of these things have allowed me complete serenity on their own. It's not the case.
So can you take us then to the story of how you found Al-Anon?
Certainly. It is by divine intervention, I would say. It's remarkable how it comes about. I was searching for AA on the interwebs, and obviously to get somebody sober. I was gonna get them there
for your current project.
For my current obsession, and it was not out of the kindness of my own heart. I wasn't an Al-Anon member that was like, I really want them to get sober and healthy. I'm like, you're gonna get sober and healthy because this is uncomfortable for me. This is not good for me. And while I was on the website, I saw Al-Anon, and I'm like, that looks like that could be a place that would make my life more comfortable. And so I went, I'm notoriously selfish. And I'm like, that looks good. It's unlikely they'll ever go to AA. How about I go there? And I went to one, and this was in 2011. And the second Al-Anon meeting was on the 10th of May 2023. So there is a gap.
Mm-hmm.
And in that gap, I caused a lot of havoc because there's, without a program of action and without a guiding light, the family members and the friends who are around alcoholics or are not around alcoholics, if we've been affected, are often, in my experience, we're often sicker than the alcoholics.
Yeah. And are you with an alcoholic for that whole time between 2011 and 2013?
I made it my personal job for that to be the case. Mm-hmm. And I didn't even know. I did not even know. So the second Al-Anon meeting, I found myself in a car park, and I am so grateful that my partner at the time mentioned to me so gently, "Have you thought about going to Al-Anon?" And it was like I had never thought about it. And they were in active recovery in AA. And I can't believe it never crossed my mind before they mentioned it. And I was...
Had you dismissed it for a particular reason in 2011? You just hadn't wandered back there?
It was like something... It was like a divine intervention. It was like it never entered my mind. And it makes me think that when the time is right, if someone's listening, when the time is right and you hear something and it goes off in your head, you know. When you're feeling sweaty, when your heart's racing, you know. And no one can make it happen for you. You just know. And, like, there might be people that have been telling you for ages and it might be 10 years ago, but when you hear it, you know. And so when I heard it, like 11 years later or whatever.
It's the right time and the right person.
Yeah.
It was amazing. So I went the next week and I went to 5 meetings a week. Thereafter, I got a sponsor and I started. I haven't stopped doing the steps since I started.
What did you like about it? Why did you know it was the right thing for you?
I was backed up against the wall. It was my last choice because of all the things I had tried beforehand. And the there's literature, a lot of literature, because my former partner was in AA. I was privy to their literature as well. There's a line that's had active. It tells you to, try everything first.
Mm-hmm.
Give it a go. So I literally tried everything first. And then Al-Anon was the last stop. It's the last stop. So if that doesn't work, there is nothing else. And it's, but have you tried? Yes, I actually have. No, but did you? Yes. Like you could have people call in and go, but did you really? But 3 days? Yes, I did. So by spiritual means alone, it does not work. You know, I used to go get up at 3 in the morning, drive to a chapel and pray for 4 hours straight. Spiritual means alone wasn't going to help me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I used to go to a psychiatrist. I used to go to a psychologist. You know, I was suicidal. It was absolutely, I used to cry and rock and cry. Like, it was just, like, they talk about it as alcoholic torture.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It was horrendous.
And so what did you hear at your first Al-Anon meeting? Can you remember what the...
Brilliant question. Absolutely brilliant. My first Al-Anon meeting, the woman there, she'd been there for about 400 years.
Yeah.
And she said to me, and I think if I was anyone else, there was three women there.
That was it? It was a four-person meeting?
Yep. And she said, and I've got to put a voice on.
Okay. All right, Beryl.
Here we go, love. She goes, darling, when I was with my alcoholic husband, she goes, oh, no, I can't do it. I can't say it. She goes, she said she wanted to stick a knife in him. Like she,
Yeah.
And you know what? I mean, I don't think I wanted to stick a knife in anyone, but I mean, I was in an Al-Anon meeting this morning, and I don't reckon I would have been laughed out of the meeting if I had shared that as well.
Oh, I said something similar recently at an Al-Anon meeting. That is the rage that it can provoke in you, the frustration and the rage and the anger and the disappointment. So, yeah, that was the first thing you heard. Anything else?
Well, I think the second thing that sparked my attention, and it was at the Diamond Creek meeting, and we were having a cup of tea afterwards, and one fella said, just off the cuff, he goes, well, it's a spiritual program. And I went, is it? Oh. And it was like, oh, I've come home. Because I had come from a place where I thought I would find something to heal me. And it was a spiritual institution. And I was so unwell, they didn't know what was wrong with me. And then now I'm in this place and they're all got the same thing wrong with them.
Yeah, isn't that a relief?
Amazing.
Yeah. Right, that's it. Right, so it was the connection of doing the work but connected to the actual problem, the real problem, in the company of other people with the same problem. All right, so can you talk, we've only got a few more minutes, can you talk about what the program is for you, maybe how you work the steps or how it is a spiritual program or anything you like that you'd like to say?
Wonderful. I've come to find that my former partner, my former husband, was completely right, and my mum was right, my former partner was right, my teachers were probably right, and I can finally accept I have been so wrong.
What were they right about, and what have you been wrong about?
Yeah. It's a beautiful position to sit in, which is I can finally accept that I don't have all the answers. Because that's a place where I can be changeable.
It's a great liberation as well, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. And I come into the program, and for the first time in my entire life, I know that if I'm starting at a point where I am potentially wrong, but I've got a program that shows me really simply that there's a solution, and this solution is a very, very beautiful guiding light to a power that's just bigger than me. All I have to do is look and go, Phoebe Lou, you're not God. I mean, it is the hardest thing to accept, but I am not God. And that there might be something else out there that is. It's so simple.
Mm-hmm.
It's the hardest thing for me to contemplate every single day.
Mm-hmm.
But this program of action helps me contemplate it.
Mm-hmm.
So all that said, it really has become like a love affair going through these steps. Yeah. It has.
Yeah.
And I can have connections with this family of mine, my blood family,
mm-hmm.
and also have connections with other men and other women that I absolutely never thought that I could.
Mm-hmm.
This is wild, absolutely wild. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the little girl that felt humiliated in front of the class is now talking in a microphone on the radio.
It is amazing.
And I'm not shaking.
Yep. Because you're confident. You know exactly what you're saying.
Yeah.
Mm. We're going to have to go. We've only got 2 more minutes and we've got to leave some room for Balanois. So thank you so much for coming in. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Anne.
Thanks, Akia, too.
Thank you for being here. It was amazing. It touched my heart, your story.
Thanks for having me, ladies.
Yeah.
If you're concerned about drinking in a relative or friend and would like to find out more about Al-Anon family groups, then you can phone them on 1-300-252-666 or go online at alanon.org.au. If the content in the part that you just listened to has raised questions or caused distress to you, please call Lifeline on 13 11 14 or visit lifeline.org.au. Coming up next, we have Balanois, the Spirit of Wa, hosted by Uncle Teljum Choco Edwards. Join Uncle Choco on a journey of belonging and movement through sing-alongs and yarns. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and stay tuned now to 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.